Hi, everyone, and we're welcome to the Neil Haley Show. And I have a really exciting co-host today from the 80s Hour, a podcast and radio show and television show, Juan Alemán. Juan, thanks for stopping by. And you're excited about our guest. And you know what? I was going back to his music and some of his songs, and his fan base is tremendous, especially on YouTube. Introduce our guest.
Yes, today we have with us a guy who's been a recording artist for over 50 years, some great music in the 70s and into the 80s, and his name is Lobo. How are you today, sir?
I'm fine, and how are you?
Hi. I'm doing excellent.
Awesome. Awesome. All right, so let's go ahead and let's get right to the questions you have for Lobo, and I'm excited to learn because, Juan, you're a musician yourself, right? Are you, you're musical, you do musical stuff too? Is that correct?
Actually, I love music. I don't have that talent. My son is a musician.
Okay.
Yeah, but my son writes music. He performs. And I find that talent to be so unique in that when someone can put their feelings down into words and to set it to music is wonderful. What, when you first started writing music, how old were you?
Actually, I had been, started being a musician on a flute from a talent show at high school and all that other stuff. But as I went to college and flunked out the first year, and I was informed if I want to go back, I'll pay for it. I found out that playing two or three nights a week paid the same as working at a store all. And I got into it that way. I was approached by a guy in a bar one night I was playing in, and he said that he was a producer. You know, you hear this crap all the time. And so I'm taking it with tongue in cheek. And, oh, he produced Maurice Williams Day and it's back in the 50s. And anyway, this guy was Phil Gernhardt, who was just trying to go to law school. And he was hustling. He was hustling a band to do a recording for somebody. And he wanted us to play the music. And that's how I got, and that's how I met him. And then we had a local record, which was real successful, just in Tampa, in St. Petersburg, that area. And then all of a sudden, I had to go in the Army Reserve for 6 months. I came back. He had all the Snoopy versus the Red Baron stuff. And then he had Abraham Martin and John with Dion. And so all of a sudden, he was back to being a big-time producer. And I had direct access to him. Very difficult person to put up with. But he made a statement to me that it was, in one way it was good, one way it was kind of, you know. He said, you know, you're only an okay singer. And I just said, okay. And he said, but if you ever want to have a hit song or a record, you better write it, because nobody's going to give you a hit song. And that's what, that statement is what made me sit in hour after hour working on it until I started getting proficient at it. And then finally, you know, you come up with a hit. And to this day, being forced to write my own songs is what has given me the freedom for all these years, not to have jets and all that crap. It's to not have to do things you don't want to do. That's what financial and just plain freedom was always to me. And so that's how I got into it. That was my avenue in.
You know, it's interesting. I was checking out your music on YouTube, and the songs, really, your songwriting is what made the songs, right? I mean, you had the look, you had everything, but the stories that you're able to tell in your songs is what really set you apart from your competition. Would you agree, your writing?
Yeah, what it is, and you don't know, and we were talking briefly before this interview started about music in general, and it is to me as a stranger phenomenon as religion, because there's no explanation for either one, you know, and so you can believe, you cannot believe, but I think a song gets to an individual quicker than a preacher does. A preacher has to work his way in and get your confidence. The song takes you right there. You know, if it hits your heart, that I was able to do that was absolutely amazing to me. That I thought I was writing my own little secret thoughts And all of a sudden, the whole world was singing. I mean, literally, my stuff was every country in the world, and I couldn't comprehend that. And then after all these years and doing interviews and when you talk about yourself, you kind of have to. You think you're hiding your stuff, but you're not. You're really saying what you mean, and sometimes you stick your foot in your mouth, and that's okay too. But that emotional connection with people is the most phenomenal part of everything. Not the records, not the shows. It's that sitting in that room with that guitar, and I've got it, same guitar I've had for over 50 years sitting over in the chair there. I was playing it before we started. It's any guitar player, there's a guitar in the room, he's going to pick it up and play it. My old guitar, that old Martin guitar, it has such an emotional connection with my life works. And I did a deal. I've never sung for anybody anywhere except just a few shows. And I, one of my 50th high school reunion, there were a couple of hundred people I've never sung for. And I just got up there and sang three songs. And I said to him, I said, the strangest part about all this is if you told me 50 years ago that this was what I would have done my whole life, I would have laughed. You know, I would have gone buy another six pack and go ride around in the car and whoopee-doo, you know. But so it's a strange deal, man. It still affects me that way.
Wow. That's an amazing journey. 50 plus years all around the world. And tons of albums sold, memorable songs. I was looking at some of the music that you wrote before we started the interview, and memorable stuff. And when you get into the 80s, I noticed that you did some country music.
Yeah, that was, I'll tell you how that happened. I heard a song on the radio. It was when I lived in California briefly. I'm not a California person. I lived out in Malibu, laying in one of those houses, and tried to play like seeing movie stars at the grocery store was natural, but it didn't work. But I heard a song, and I think the name of it was The Cowboy and the, it was a Bobby Goldsboro song. I loved the production. It was a country pop kind of thing. And I found out it was a guy named Bob Montgomery in Nashville. Bob had the rights to The Wind Beneath My Wings. I mean, he was big time. I went to him. I said, Bob, listen, I did some research on you. I'd love for you to do an album. And I had a deal with Curb, and Curb approved him. Well, we started to do the album, and that was I had a song called Where Were You When I Was Falling in Love, which in the top 20 in pop, but it was number one easy listening or anything. But as we started getting into this album, and he kept pushing songs on me from his publishing company. And I did them because I said, he's a producer. But it ended up being a kind of a hokey, semi R&B pop Lobo garbage. You know, Where Were You When I Was Falling in Love is a great song, it's a great record until he put all the strings and girls' voices and all this crap going on it. But I wanted to get into country. That was what I liked, because I love my wife, which we hadn't been together but a few years back then. She was a big country music fan, and I started listening to the early 70s country, and that stuff's great. I mean, you know, it's just Eddie Raven. I mean, I love those records. But I did this album, and I had the success of whatever. It wasn't that big of a deal. But I had gotten a connection in Nashville, and so I went up there, and I bought a house. I bought a music row, a building down on Music Row, and I was writing. And I wrote this song. Actually, it was about when President Reagan was shot. And I wrote a song called The First Cowboy. And what it was is, it'll take a lot more than that to kill an old cowboy. A lot more than that to bring the first cowboy down.
Right.
He'll be back on the horse. He'll be back on his horse before the dust even settles, because it takes a lot more than that to bring the first cowboy down. Really kind of a corny little country song. And I took it to my publisher at the time, Famous, and they took it to a guy who had an independent label. Anyway, we got a little record, didn't do anything, but I made this connection with this guy, and he was a sweetheart of a guy. I mean, I loved the guy, I loved his family, but he was just an old-time Nashville hustler. And I let him stay in my building for free. And we funded this little country label. The first thing I cut was a thing called I Don't Want to Want You. I cut it in a cheap studio. WSM in Nashville started playing it. And they played it to death. And it was a big local hit. And actually, I didn't know until years later or months later that a national label had wanted to pick the record and go country with it. But this guy that I was in business with, he wanted to build an independent label. And I didn't know that he had passed on that deal. Well, this guy had no clout. He just had hustle. And so we had three or four records that got halfway up the country charts. And it was more fun. We used to play golf more than we worked. You know, we would play a little music, go play a little golf. But that's how I got into that. And I produced a thing on Joe Stampley, which is a top five country song. I had a top five writer song with Christy Lane, who had that One Day at a Time big gospel thing. So, I mean, I had some, and Stonewall Jackson, of course, had Me and You and a Dog Named Boo as the top five countries. So I had sort of a connection, but I'm not a good mixer with people. I don't hang out. So Nashville at that time was very much an old buddy hangout. You do me a favor, I'll do you a favor. And I didn't, back to what I said before, having the big pop song, worldwide songs that I had written and the income from that, I didn't have to do anything to maintain myself. And so I had kind of a free slide, which probably if I'd needed and needed to blend more in order to get things done, I could have done more. But I got tired of it, you know, and I bought another building and sold them. I'm always messing with real, or was used to mess with real estate. So that's how I kind of got in the country deal. It's a long way to get to where we are, right. But old people do that, you know, us old guys, we talk in circles.
All right. So let's talk about, I want to talk about the transition between the 70s and 80s. Did you know that transition was going to happen, especially with going into the 80s and music and how you started to reinvent yourself with country music and stuff, that the style of music you sung before will not get over in the 80s, in your opinion? It's different now, especially with what we're seeing in music today, right? Music's just blowing up of all different generations.
Well, you know, I really, when I went to Nashville, the last thing I wanted to do was promote myself. What I wanted to do was have a publishing company produce. Once again, like I said before, I'm not one for the spotlight. I love the studio. I love writing, do all that other stuff. I don't mind doing shows, but I don't want to be the center of attention. I'm a guy that sits in the back, drinks a beer. You know, that kind of deal, or used to be. I don't drink beer anymore. I had enough of that thing. But anyway, I wasn't out to had anything to do with Lobo. It had to do with just me as a songwriter. And Nashville, you're only as good as the song that's on the charts that day. I could rip off Glenn Campbell, Liza Minnelli, Petula Clark, Donna Fargo, on and on, these people that have recorded my songs. It means nothing. What means something is I have a song now that George Strait is cutting. I mean, that's what Nashville is and was. And I really didn't fit into that mold. So I stayed 5-6 years and then went back to Florida. Then I went back again when we started getting active in the 90s, doing all that recording for overseas. It was easier to be there because we cut probably 100 tunes in that era. And that's what all these cuts that are showing up on the Time Life deal. That's what they are. And we had great budgets to cut this stuff because we leased it. So there was no schlocky, cheap records in there. They're all great productions and great recording. And it's funny, you know, that here we are now, 50 years later, and we're talking about the same music that I played 50 years ago and is still being played, you know, that figure that people keep throwing at me, 1.5 million listeners on Spotify every month. I'm thinking, what? You know,
yeah, I, 10 million I thought it was of your songs on YouTube.
Oh, I know. You know what it is? They had a deal back in the day when, you know, everybody was trying to figure out how to get another hit record. And they had a deal I think it was in Dallas or somewhere. I don't know where. Anyway, and they hired these people, and they went in and they put a headset on, and they played songs for them. They had 8 songs, and they could switch between them. And what they were looking for was the song came on, and the guy reached and switched to another one, okay? And that was called a turnoff factor. And they avoided records with turnoff factors because it limits your audience. I had one of the highest ratings for no turnoff factor. Not that they were so excited to hear my stuff, but didn't bother them. And that's sort of always been my shtick. It's not something you're going to yay at the concert about. It's something, if I start singing one of my hits at a show, you kind of do this. You know, you kind of get in that mood. And that's, it's not really concert music. When I play in Asia, they cry. My wife is at the first show I do in Asia. She said, "You wouldn't believe it. You start singing one of the ballads and everybody in the whole room is crying." And I'm thinking, man, I need to eat more rice or something. I don't know what the hell's going on here. But it's a strange deal, you know. I still have trouble relating to that type of thing. And getting emails where people say, you know, you've been the paving on the road of my life and this sort of stuff. And I appreciate it. And I don't know. I always suspect that they write the same message to 20 people and just send it to different artists. But I don't think that's true. But, you know, Paul Overstreet, one of the best country writers in the world. One time I did a show with him. Actually, it was just to play in a golf tournament. And there were all these little country writers that were so eaten up with their importance. And Paul said to me, "Kent, you only can do one song." And I didn't want to do it anyway. So I said, to Billy, my partner who sings with me, I said, "Billy, what we're going to do is we're going to play half of Me and You and a Dog Named Boo and half of I'd Love You to Want Me." Well, these people, the other writers, except for Paul Overstreet, of course, they had 1 or 2 country hits, which nobody remember anyway. Well, they were talking about who goes on when. And I said to Paul, Paul's a funny guy. I said, "Paul, listen, if you want me to," I said, "I'll bring the people in. I said, I'll play while they come and sit down, and then I won't take anybody's slot." And Paul stopped and turned around and looked at me and said, "Kent, we need to work on your ego." So he said, it was the funniest thing. And I still remember that to this day. And you know what we did? We went out there and we started, you know, Me and a Dog Named Boo has that. I started playing it, and this crowd is about 1,000 people in this little thing at a casino, just erupts. They just go crazy. And I sang half of Me and a Dog Named Boo, and then it goes, "I love being a me man." I go, "Prang when I saw you standing." I mean, you thought I was at your Beatles concert. And so we got off and went down the road, and all these little eaten up with themselves songwriters who wanted to go last or before this guy were just kind of sitting there with this long look on their face. You know, they have to go out after that. And it was just like, whatever you guys want, it's fine with me. We won the golf tournament, by the way.
Now, I have a question for you. Since I do an 80s show, I cover a lot of 80s artists. If you had had the opportunity at that time during the 80s to duet with any 5 people, who would you have picked?
The 80s were not my era. If I go back, the person I would love to have a record with more than anybody, except I would hate my voice to be on the same thing with, is Karen Carpenter. Absolutely the best. Yeah, that's, everybody does the same thing. That voice just, she opens her mouth and it flows out like pudding, you know. It's thicker than water, and poor little thing was so insecure and you know, killed herself and all this other stuff, and her brother, who never gets a lot of credit, was brilliant. He put the harmony parts, Karen Carpenter, I liked anybody would like to sit down with James Taylor, but once again, that would be like a new Mercedes with an old Dodge van. Guess who's the old Dodge van? But would I appreciate it? Yes. David Gates and I pretty much sang very much alike. We almost did some shows together, and I mentioned to them, I said, you know what would be really cool, and because we had the output to do it, I said, I would do I like Everything I Own is my favorite. But, you know, I'd give everything I own. And he could do I Love You, Army, Don't Expect Me to Be a Friend, one of mine. And we're doing the same arrangement. We just switch the voices. His people said that, yeah, he might be interested in doing that, but the thing never came together. But that's the type of people. Most people would out-sing me because my style is so much. I can't explain why they accepted my voice. I have no idea except what that thing I told you before about the no turnoff factor. I don't piss anybody off. I mean, I don't have them standing on their seats, but I don't make them mad. And you know, and music shouldn't be as violent and as harsh as it is today. Now, I'm going to say right here that I'm going to interject something in today's music, and it's probably not going to be what you think about the harshness and all this stuff. I'm going to say two names, and that sums up what's right about music. Obviously, Ed Sheeran. Okay? Taylor Swift. These are two geniuses. Have you heard the Joker and the Princess, or Joker and the Queen? It's a brand new song they got out, and the two of them doing that together. It's called The Joker and the Queen. I mean, that's what's right with music, because that could have been done back in my era. It doesn't make any difference. It's so good. And so I know it's a roundabout way who would I sing with. I would be easily intimidated. Because it used to take me so long to get good vocals, you know, it just, actually there's something in the works about singing with a young girl now that's a very, I don't want to mention names, very operatic. I mean, comes so different from me, but there's a possibility of that, of something happening with that. And it's all just out hanging there. You know?
Now, what do you think the reason why music from your generation, all the older music now is going viral? This whole push now that everyone is really in to music from other time periods, and that they're saying new music is really not doing well with downloads and listens and versus music of the past. Why do you think it's happening?
I believe, and music has always been to me, and I use this example every time somebody asks me this question. Remember Brandy, the song Brandy, you're for a fine girl, what a good life you should be. Anyway, it's about a little girl, and the sailor comes in, and she waits for him. And this is a big hit in the 70s. I can see the picture of that little girl in the village in Scotland, waiting on the ship to come in, and Brandy, you're a fine girl, and all that stuff. The mental picture that it takes me, I didn't have anybody showing me a video. I don't know what Brandy looks like, okay? But in my mind, as soon as I hear that song, that's where I go. You know, I hear Carolina on My Mind by James Taylor, and we all do that. Sweet Baby James, the turnpike from Dockbridge to Boston, you know. I mean, the beauty of songs that gently take you a place that you're happy to be, not fighting emotions to see, do you agree with this or not? Because you need to take a stand. You need to stand up. And if you don't, I'll shoot you. You know, nobody shot anybody in the 70s. I'll tell you, the only time I ever heard of somebody shooting somebody in Winter Haven, Florida, where I live, the Pontiac dealer caught his wife and a salesman in bed together and killed them both with one shot. Hey, isn't that cool? That's the only time I ever heard of a gun being used. And that was like a bizarre one-off instance. Heck, they're shooting people across town here in Fort Myers, Florida. You know, I'm glad I'm old, because if the world is going the way that it appears to be going now, we've got Rootin' Bootin' over there. He can't wait to get his boys into the Ukraine or wherever it is. I lived through Vietnam. I didn't have to go. I was in the reserves because my career, if I had gone to Vietnam, my career would have never happened because the timing was right. But I did what I had to do. I was in reserve 1600. My buddy Billy that works with me was over there in the trenches, man. He still has stuff from it.
Oh man.
I don't like this violent world. I don't, I live in a, on a ninth floor of a condo that's secure. And my place up in the mountains is just in a real kind of a nondescript little house in a little, on a little golf course, but it's nothing. I don't live in any type of place people think I would live in or do things that they think I would do. I've been married to my wife for 45, 6 years. We spent 45 or 6 years together. We very rarely go out. We very rarely, it's the greatest thing now with Netflix and Amazon and all these things, that we see movies. We never went to the movies. So this being in with a plague that we have now, whatever it is, you know, we're watching all these movies that everybody else is seeing, you know, so it's great, man. Like the Gilmore Girls. I mean, we watched that whole Gilmore Girls, all 15 seasons or whatever it was. I loved every one of them.
So what's your big, I have to ask Netflix, what are you watching on Netflix right now?
My wife will not watch anything violent.
Okay.
So, but after I get off the Hallmark channel, you mean, and I go into Netflix, it's basically the Hallmark movies that are on Netflix. We don't watch anything. The Gilmore Girls is a very good example of what I watched on Netflix. We watched something about a river. I can't remember it. And they're all serious, you know, watching it. Yeah, and then you can watch them all. You know, all of a sudden you realize it's 3 o'clock in the morning and you've watched 10 of these things. And
exactly, yeah.
It's great. But see, we never did any of that before. We go to bed early and get up early.
You're traveling so much and the road and all that stuff. And
No. You don't understand. This is a true fact, and I want you to think in your mind, how many days are in 50 years? How many weekends are in 50 years? I did approximately in 50 years, 150 shows total in 50 years.
Oh, wow.
People don't understand. I know this is why you didn't know me from Adam. You didn't know if I was David Gates or Jeffrey Dahmer. You know, I mean, it's just nobody knew. And this is fun doing it this way because I feel like I'm sneaking in the side door. I'm still getting in and sitting in the back room watching myself do this interview on television. I'm not standing in front of the people doing it. That's why I'm comfortable doing this where I wasn't back in the heyday.
That's great. That makes sense. So you're enjoying that. It's definitely talking about the streaming. All right, Juan, what's your next question?
Okay, my next question is, I mean, you've talked about Netflix. You said that you might have something coming up soon. Is this going to be a song like a one-off, or do you have a whole album coming up?
Well, believe it or not, there's two different. This is what this Netflix thing is. It's like we own a record label now. We have somebody who, because I get plays and it's picking up all the time. If we say to them, listen, I've got this thing where I'm singing to my dog. Okay, that's great. Put it on there because nobody else has it. That's the key to this whole deal, is they have to go and be subscribers to see the stuff that nobody else can see. So the possibility of this young female girl, that's a real long shot, because I don't know how I would sing with her. But the other thing that we're in talks about was, I think I mentioned Paul Overstreet before, and he's a genius. He's an absolute genius. I didn't get along so good with him 20 years ago or 30 years ago when I met him, but we rubbed each other wrong, whatever. But my guy, Billy, who's been with me for 50 years, also worked for Paul for a long time, has written with Paul year after year. They had Kenny Chesney Cutts, Joe Cocker, all this stuff. Well, Paul and Billy and I are going to work on a project that, in essence, I'm going to sing two of Paul's biggest hits. He's going to sing two of mine. Paul is a great artist. Paul can sit down with a guitar and knock you dead. I mean, and then we're going to kind of put a trio thing together. It's in the experimental stage. And that's the beauty of the technology now. You can do it. I can do it in Florida. Paul's on the other side of Nashville, and Billy's in Franklin, in Tennessee. We can do it like we're doing right now. We can sit down with a guitar and work on it. And it's beautiful. I wish I had something I could play for you or send to you. but we haven't started it yet. This just came about recently, and Paul was all for it.
Yeah.
Paul sings better now than he sang 30 years ago. He is phenomenal. I'd love for him to sing. I hear his voice on Meaning and a Dog Named Blue. That's the kind of voice he probably should have been on in anyway. And so this is what's so exciting about this format. The Time Life people say, send it to us. If it's something we can't use, if you run it by us and we say, yeah, that'll work, it doesn't have to be exactly the way we see it. If you see it this way, we'll give it a try. Right. In the old days, man, I'd go in there and cut four songs, and if they didn't hear a hit, they'd chunk them in the backyard. My second album I ever recorded, I was charged as an artist all the recording costs. It was never released.
Oh, wow.
Never put out. A tune of it will show up every now and then. I don't know where they came from. And that kind of stuff. And what they do is they keep the artist always behind. Okay, you have a hit, and you have to go and record an album. Well, that eats up all your royalties for the single. And then you get the second, and then you got to get the next album because you have a four album deal. Well, by the time you get around to income coming in, you've got to make up for four albums. It's the working for the country store deal, man.
Exactly. You know,
the cotton pickers out there, and they go and they get credit at the store, and then by the time they get paid, they just pay the store. Well, that's what record companies are.
You have a better deal with Time Life than you like if dealing with Spotify and getting paid, meaning that you have a great opportunity with Time Life releasing all this stuff, and you're of a good partner, and that's what makes you excited, and that they're able to go with your creativity and what you're looking for, unlike a lot of today's types of deals, right? Wouldn't you agree? So with the whole...
Why do you think Taylor Swift is buying all of her stuff back, re-recording it all? Because she has control over it. I tell you what, the most exciting part of this is the concept. And this is what absolutely threw me for a loop when I thought about it. The end user on internet music, the guy, in my case, a guy in India, a guy in Brazil, a guy in Iceland, all over the world, can pick up his phone on his local thing and say, you know, I'd like to hear Meaning and a Dog Named Blue, and play it, go to the Time Life thing, oh, here's a song, plays it. What does it cost him? Zero. Nothing. The end user pays nothing. The advertiser pays for it. That little thing where it says skip the ad, you know, after 30 seconds, right, you skip it. Now, tell me, that concept isn't brilliant. So we go to Time Life, as in the old days, even my big hits that I would pick up Billboard magazine, and I'd see I was number 5 in South Africa, and then I was number 8 in Norway. Now I'm just all over the world. Well, now if you had charts and they were working that way, you could put it online and go back 2 days later, and they'll tell you exactly all over the world, not just one place at a time. One play is going everywhere.
That's great.
That's a phenomenal. It's beyond words for me.
Exactly. I mean, yeah.
And we have creative control.
Right.
And if it doesn't work, you take it off.
Exactly.
We don't ask them for the money to record this because it doesn't cost us anything. We all have the equipment. We all have the instruments. I'm going to hire a string quartet to do some of the stuff. I don't want to overdub, make it big strings. I just want a string quartet. That's a cello. I think it's a cello, 2 violas, and a violin. No, one viola and 2 violins.
Absolutely. All right, we're getting close to running out of time. So go to Time Life. Where can we go to listen to your music right now? Go to Time Life. Is it because
you go in Lobo, the official Time Life? I'm sorry, the official YouTube channel. It says Lobo, the official YouTube channel, and it'll take you right to that site. Now I must have 100 songs on there already.
Fantastic.
It's amazing.
And definitely, you know, it's going to do really well, especially what we've seen. Other things have been on YouTube. All right. And lastly, Juan, where can we find information on you? Where can we go?
Yes, you can go to pictureperfectpodcast.com. There you can find information about the 80s hour, about me. If you want to contact me, just click on contact me, and you can send me an email and I'll be sure to contact you back. I really appreciate your time today, Lobo. Very informative.
Sure, Juan. I mean, I enjoyed talking to you. You know, I don't do this enough that I get bored with it.
That makes sense. That's a good thing. And then again, my podcast, not just when I talk about radio and television, is ranked number 16 celebrity podcast in the world, according to FeedSpot. So I have one of the top celebrity podcasts. Everyone needs to go to Time Life, check out Lobo and Lobo Official. Appreciate it. Go to YouTube. And how did you get the name Lobo? And if could you give me it in like a minute? Because I only got like a minute left. How did you get the name Lobo?
Go. I've already explained to you how I did not want to be out front. Okay, so I didn't want to go with my name on the record. So the producer said, look for names. So I just wrote a whole bunch of stuff. And one of them had to be Lobo. And when it came to it, and I was reading the list, he said, what does that mean? And I said, it means wolf in Spanish. He said, that's perfect. And at the first record, Meanie and Dog Named Boo, they also on the reviews mentioned, of course, they thought it was a group. The name of the group, Lobo, is being very picaresque. You have to look that one up because I didn't know what it meant either.
This was a great brand name. Yeah,
exactly. But it's easy to remember. And here's the thing. When you got 300 people after a show waiting for you to sign something, you know how long it takes to sign Lobo?
I see. Well, I had to sign either Giant Warrior or Big Neil, the Real Deal. I was a former professional wrestler. I'd have to go and sign the autographs. And you know, I know it takes time. It's not an easy deal for sure. So
Remember a guy named Tiny? Can't remember what he went. I played golf with him. And he was a professional wrestler. On probably the smaller circuit.
The India circuit. I was on the India circuit, but also went to Germany and wrestled for the WWF. Cool. So, all right. Well, appreciate you guys both. Great show. And take care. We'll stay in touch, Lobo. We'll check out more of your music. I love the song, Me and My Dog Named Boo. It's just really heartwarming. Traveling the country with a dog and sure. Your loved one. So that's awesome. So I appreciate you guys. Take care. And thanks again.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. That was the Neil Haley Show. Take care, guys.